Chapter 26. And then I got three dead cats in the mail. Conversation I had with my friend Miley. I should mention that it's really good you're listening to the audiobook, because if you were reading the book, you would say, why is this girl's name Mail? Because it looks like Mail, but it's pronounced Miley, like Miley Cyrus, except that she had the name before Miley Cyrus, and she would like me to point that out. She was born way before Miley Cyrus was. She would like me to take out that last sentence. Guess what I got in the mail yesterday, I said to Miley. Something gross? Oh my God, how did you do that? I'm psychic, plus I've met you. So, what did you get in the mail yesterday? A bunch of dead cats. Ew. Taxidermied? Nope. Oh, said Miley. Fuck. Right? You got some dead, rotting cats in the mail? Well, they aren't rotting, I explained. All of the insides were squished out, so they're like cat sleeves? Who would send you cat sleeves? I don't know. There was no note. They were just in a grocery sack. And the mystery deepens. I did have an email conversation last month with this woman who said she had some cat skins that she wanted to send me. But, and the mystery is solved because it was never a mystery to begin with, she interrupted. It was just you not giving me enough information because you were terrible at telling stories. Well, no. I replied, not exactly, because this lady said that she had these totally ethically achieved dead cats. Stop, she said. That's not a thing. No, seriously. She said she worked at this vet hospital, but when they had cats that were already run over or had to be put down because they were cancerous, they would have all of these dead cats left over and no one would ever claim them and they didn't want to just waste them. So they sold the insides to vet schools so they could dissect them, but then they had all this fur left over. So they tanned them and used them as packaging material when they needed to mail stuff. They used dead cats as packing peanuts? That is disgusting. What were they shipping? Human torsos? Well, technically, it's sort of eco-green in kind of the grossest way ever. Anyway, she said she wanted to make me some kitten mittens because of the time that I wrote about them. Wait, hang on. Why would kittens need mittens? No, Miley, mittens made out of kittens. You know, for the homeless. I already regret asking this, but what in the fuck are you talking about? Okay, a couple of years ago, I came up with this idea to repurpose used breast pumps to suck dead kittens inside out because then, ta-da, fur-lined mittens for homeless people. And I told my friend Craig about it, and he was all, that's weird. And I'm all, it's weird no one's ever thought of it before because no one wants dead kittens or used breast pumps. And so this way, we'd be keeping both of them out of the landfills and we'd be helping the homeless. It's practically carbon zero. And then Craig mentioned something about PETA and firebombs. And I was all, I'd only use kittens that were already dead from non-communicable diseases, Craig. I wouldn't go around haphazardly turning live kittens inside out. I'm not a monster, for God's sakes. Frankly, I was a little insulted that I even had to clarify that. I'm doing this to help the homeless, not for my own personal kitten mitten collections. I mean, I live in Texas. I don't even need mittens. Wow, Miley said. You're so altruistic. Yeah, exactly. So I was expecting a pair of ethically made kitten mittens in the mail, but then I got these skinned, untailored cats instead. And here's the weird thing. There are three of them. Yeah, the weird thing about you getting a bunch of dead cats in the mail is the number of them. Yeah, because I have two hands and three cats to put on them. What is that implying? Huh. Maybe they're supposed to be leg warmers. I don't have three legs, Miley. Well, maybe it's two leg warmers and a penis cozy. I don't have it. Are you even listening to me? Well, are you listening to yourself? You want to use dead kittens as leg warmers. I shouldn't be the one getting defensive here. Touche. How do you even get ethically skinned cats? Well, I said, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Oh, Jesus, I'm going to pretend you never said that. Are you kidding me? I've been waiting this whole conversation to use that joke. I know, and I'm your friend in spite of it. Oh, my God. I just realized I have three cats, and I have three ethically skinned dead cats. Halloween costumes for cats! Who could go as different cats, I offered. That is a terrible costume, she replied. Well, the skins are long and thin, Maybe I could use them as wine koozies? And there was no note, she asked. Nope, just 3 dead cats in a grocery sack. Canvas or plastic? Plastic. Well, that's no good for the environment. I'm pretty sure that woman was lying to you and she's just trying to hide her crimes against humanity. Technically, they would be crimes against cats. Cat-manity. I don't think that's a word, Miley said. It sounds like what you'd get if you crossbred a cat and a manatee. Or, I said, if you put a cat suit on a small manatee. Yeah, I think you're looking for clues that aren't there. I have a bag full of dead cats, Miley. I can't be expected to think logically. Do you think the woman was thinking logically when she sent me a box of dead cats? You gotta think like a serial killer to catch a serial killer, Miley. You think she's a serial killer? No, that was a bad analogy. I just meant that you have to think like a cat skinner to figure out why you have 3 cat skins in your garage. Wait, why are they in your garage? I should keep them in my house? Way to scare the shit out of my cats, bad cat mom. That would be like if you brought home the skins of young children and let your kids see them. Although, the cats might take me more seriously when I tell them to stop peeing on the couch if they saw a skinned cat lying around. Oh my god, I could totally put one on the couch that Ferris Mueller keeps peeing on, and then I'd be like, yeah, Ferris, that's what happened to the last cat who peed here. Is that why your cat keeps glaring at me? Am I sitting on the pee couch? Just because you mark it doesn't mean you own it, Ferris. Stop with the glaring. Ew, Miley said. Don't worry, it's been cleaned, and I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that Ferris would be like, all the cats are accounted for, and I've lived here since the beginning of time. I'm not falling for that. But here's the deal. Cats have terrible memories. Ferris can't even remember where the litter box is, apparently. Actually, said Miley, I'm just thinking I'd like to move to another couch. P.S., I just went into the garage to find the dead cat skins so that I could include a photo in the book, but now I can't find them. I told Victor that I lost some cats in the garage, and he was all, you lost our cats in the garage? And I was like, of course not. How could I lose all 3 cats in the garage? That would make me an irresponsible mother. These cats are already dead. And then Victor and I had a fight about whether it was more or less irresponsible to lose dead cats, and I won because these motherfuckers aren't getting any less dead, Victor. Then I called our maid service and I told them that instead of cleaning the bathrooms this month, I'd prefer for them to just go through the garage and look for dead cats. And then the manager called me to say Merry Maids doesn't look for dead cats and they also don't do windows. I'm not even sure why we have a maid service anymore. Chapter 27. Things I may have accidentally said during uncomfortable silences. When I worked in human resources, we used a technique to get people to admit when they'd fucked up, and it worked so well that people would often confess to things that might not even have been true. Here's how it works. You invite the person in, and after having them sit down, you just stare at them, expectantly, and force yourself to say nothing. Most non-sociopaths have problems with awkward silences, and they will fill these silences with incriminating details about whatever it is they assume that they're in HR for. I'm not sure if this technique has a name, but I called it making out with Alan Rickman in my mind because that's what I usually did during those awkward silences. Regardless, Alan Rickman and I solved a lot of cold cases in HR. This same technique is used in homicide investigations and by a number of psychiatrists, including my own. I suspect my shrink uses it to get me to admit repressed memories or abuse, but I'm just naturally mentally ill, so instead I end up with rambling non sequiturs that do nothing but affirm that I am not in a psychiatrist's office by accident. Things I may have found myself saying to my psychiatrist after brief, awkward pauses. I'm having one of those weeks where I just want to rip off my clothes and lie in the street. Is that a medical condition? Because it feels like it. I can taste things with my eyes. Stuff like eye ointment, I mean. I don't taste solid food with my eyeballs. That would be crazy. But I probably could if I wanted to. Shit. What a terrible superpower. I need to find a skilled arsonist. I don't necessarily want to burn anything down. I just want to have the option. I need an arsonist on retainer. I'm pretty sure that's legal as long as I don't use it. Yesterday, I found out that Barack Obama isn't actually on Twitter. Honestly, I feel betrayed. This is like when Clinton fucked that girl with a cigar, except worse. My primary thoughts during the holidays are stab, 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 run away. I'm mad at everyone who never told me about House of Pies. I spent last night cleaning up 9-year-old vomit. The vomit of a 9-year-old, that is, not vomit that's 9 years old. I'm not that bad at housekeeping. I'm having one of those rare days where I love people and all of the amazing wonder they're capable of, and if someone fucks that up for me, I will stab them right in the face. Victor hates Christmas. He says the problem with nativity scenes is that there aren't enough samurais in them. I finished the Bible last night. Spoiler alert, Jesus doesn't make it. Or maybe he does now that I think about it. I may have stopped reading too soon. In my defense, though, it was getting really depressing. Honestly, that book is my Waterloo. But I guess technically Jesus didn't die. He just faked it. Or maybe it was a dream sequence. Or possibly he's a zombie or something. But it's confusing because Jesus died for our sins, but God didn't accept his death. So does that mean that our sins are still all outstanding? And when I say outstanding, I mean like they're still on the books, not like, awesome, those sins are outstanding. Some people think stuff like that is sacrilegious, but I'm pretty sure that Jesus would think this shit was hilarious. Plus, we could bond over how shitty it is to have your birthday so close to Christmas. I hate it when it's too hot for a blanket because I have this phobia that I'll float up to the ceiling without it and then I'll get chopped up by the ceiling fan. That's totally normal, right? I mispronounced my own middle name until I was 22. It's Lee, spelled L-E-I-G-H. I pronounced it Leia, like the princess. I also purposely mispronounced my last name from sixth grade on because it was Dushek, and the Czech pronunciation of it starts with douche. And I might have gotten away with it, but my sister and my mom, the lunch lady, pronounced it correctly. I just told everyone at school they just had lisps. I saw Anne Frank trending on Twitter, and I thought she died again. Turns out it was the person who found her diary that died. She's fine. And by fine, I mean, like, still dead. Not that I think it's fine that she's dead. I just think it's fine that she's not back from the dead. No one needs an Anne Frank zombie. On the way here, I saw a cloud that looked like a skull, and my first thought, Death Eaters. How am I feeling? I'm sort of in the mood to feel righteously indignant, but I don't have anything worth getting indignant about, so I guess I'm mad that people aren't stupider when I need them to be. Is it normal to regret not making a sex tape back when you were younger and your boobs still pointed vaguely at the ceiling when you were lying on your back? Because I feel like no one ever talks about that. Why do they call them map colors instead of colored pencils? Who colors maps? Who buys black and white maps? Why doesn't anyone ever answer my questions? To her credit, my psychiatrist almost never seems shocked or surprised and usually just follows it up with a calm, "And how does that make you feel?" or "Tell me more." To her discredit, she's probably just thinking about making out with Alan Rickman and isn't paying any attention to what I'm saying at all. I've considered testing this by admitting to murdering my neighbors and burying them in my basement, but I haven't actually done this because a tiny part of my mind is worried that maybe I have murdered my neighbors and buried them in my basement. It is doubtful, though, because I don't even have a basement, so it would be easy to prove my innocence if my doctor was actually listening, unless I really do have a basement and I've just repressed it to save my brain from remembering all the dead people that I've buried there. So basically, I can't test my doctor to see if she's imagining Alan Rickman naked because it's possible that the basement that I don't have is filled with people I don't remember murdering. And this is exactly the kind of thing that I should bring up in therapy. Right after I make sure that we don't have a basement. Chapter 28. My skeleton is potato-rific. When I was in junior high, most of the girls in my class were focused on the three P's: popular, pretty, and petite. It was obvious I had no chance at succeeding at any of these, so I considered creating my own three P's. I had inadvertently cornered the market on peculiar, but I couldn't think of any other good P words. My mom suggested papillos, which means possessing nipples, but I thought this was aiming rather low even for me. She offered up palmiped, web-footed, and said that if my dad glued my toes together in his taxidermy shop, no one would ever suspect it was fake, probably because most people don't intentionally fake having webbed toes. She also offered pecoris, full of cows, and potatorific, which isn't actually a real word, but is great fun to say. And it is. Say it. Potatorific. It's awesome. Then I gave up, but not before making a mental note that my mom is fairly unhelpful at superficial popularity advice and incredibly dangerous at Scrabble. When I was in the eighth grade, all of the popular girls in my class had an exclusive slumber party weekend, and a few weeks later, they all ended up with scabies. If you don't know what scabies are, you should just stop reading right here because it is so gross, you're going to want to burn your house down. Scabies are tiny creatures that burrow under your skin, lay eggs, and set up camp inside your flesh. They make lice look like a summer breeze, and the same infection in animals causes mange. You'd think that all the cool kids getting infested with flesh-eating parasites would be a great equalizer, but most of them wore it as an outward sign of having attended an exclusive event where the party favors happened to be real-life cooties. Suddenly, bug infestations were the new friendship bracelet, and some people even took to pretending to have scabies in order to fit in with the cool kids. People were literally bragging about internal bug infestations that they didn't even have. And that's when I realized that popularity is a big bunch of bullshit. Recognizing that popularity is sometimes the equivalent of human mange sort of cured me from wanting it, but I still struggle with the other P's, petite and pretty. I'm okay to look at, but there's nothing particularly striking about me. Growing up, my little sister was golden-haired and blue-eyed, and perfect strangers always said that she looked angelic and jokingly threatened to kidnap her, which is a weird joke and one that you people need to stop making. It's on par with, I just want to eat you up, which is a lot like, just looking at you is turning me into a raging cannibal. Please stop that. It's fucking creepy. I, on the other hand, was continually being told, you look just like your father. A large, intimidating, and heavily bearded man usually covered in blood. The thing I hear most often now is, don't I know you? You don't. I just have that kind of face. This was especially shitty in college when I was forever being mistaken for another girl on campus who apparently looked just like me and had a similar first name. I never met her, but she was apparently quite well known, and strangers would smile and wave and ask me if I had a cigarette. I'd explain, that's not me, I don't even smoke. You're thinking of another girl who looks just like me. And then the stranger would think I was fucking with him or was just really selfish with my cigarettes. I was sometimes a little jealous of this other, more dangerous me who was always getting high fives for stealing frat mascots or winning in drinking games while the real me was buried deep in the library. But then the other me started sleeping with married men and selling drugs. I wanted to find other me and shake her and say, you have to stop this. This isn't us. But I never ran into her. I did, however, run into several angry, accusing people whom she'd wronged and who would never believe that I wasn't me, and I sort of resented my doppelganger for pulling me into her mess. Eventually, I decided to take matters into my own hands, telling strangers who insisted that they'd had a drunken hookup with me that they should get tested for a particularly virulent strain of herpes. Random people would stop me on the sidewalk to quietly ask if I was holding, and I would tell them that the new regulations stated that I had to inform them that I may or may not be an undercover cop, and then I'd ask them exactly what they wanted. You have to talk loudly so the microphone picks it up, I'd enunciate slowly, pointing to my chest as they quickly walked away. I heard that the other me moved the next semester, possibly because of those baffling herpes undercover cop rumors she may have kept hearing about herself, and I never saw her, which was sad because it would have been interesting to see if the other me looked as nondescript as I do. Although, now that I'm thinking about it, I probably saw the other me all the time and just never even noticed her. I try not to get caught up in appearance issues, though, because my grandmother always used to say, it's what's inside that counts. And that's probably true because with my luck, my best feature would be hidden deep, deep inside my body. I suspect my best feature is my skeleton, which is a shame because it might be the most elegant and hauntingly graceful skeleton ever, but I will never get complimented on it while I'm still fleshy enough to appreciate it. And that's why I'd like people to say, "Nice skeleton," to me right now. Just give me the benefit of the doubt, you know? I've started handing out similar compliments to strangers, but not about their skeletons because that would seem disingenuous or even sarcastic since I'm pretty sure I have the sexiest skeleton ever. It's dead sexy. See what I just did there? I credit my skeleton with that joke. Clever and beautiful. No, instead I say things like, "I'd wager you have an exquisite pancreas," or "I bet your tendons are fantastic." People are usually so overwhelmed that they move away very quickly or tell me they don't have any money on them. No one is ever prepared to accept compliments from strangers about their internal organs, which just goes to show how seldom we compliment them. Souls are sort of the exception to the rule here. People are always complimenting old souls or beautiful souls or unblemished souls, but that seems like a cop-out because souls are totally invisible and never end up in bathing suit competitions. Still, people are super focused on souls. They're always trying to win them over for their particular god or sacrificing them to volcanoes or gambling them to win golden fiddles from the devil. I mean, souls are fine, but they're a bit overrated, like clavicles or the ability to roll your tongue. I mean, they're important, but we're ignoring a lot of other parts that are probably just as compliment-worthy and sexy because we're too busy complimenting firm pecs and thin waists and untarnished souls. Branch out a little is all I'm saying. It couldn't hurt. I bet your small intestines are adorable. Of course, now that I've written about how awesome my insides are, I realize I've just made my eventual skeleton incredibly tantalizing to grave robbers, and so now I'm going to have to make booby traps to protect my dead body. Like, maybe I should plan to get buried in a coffin full of glitter, because that way, if anyone in the future digs me up, they'll be like, "What the fuck? Is that glitter? That shit never goes away. Fuck that noise. Let's just rob the guy next to her. Sorry, Victor." And that's how I would keep grave robbers out. And if I get cremated, I'll have the undertaker leave my ashes way at the bottom of my glitter-filled coffin. So even if someone does decide to dig in, they won't find me until they're beard deep in glitter. And then there'll be a note in my ashes that says, "And that's what happens when you rob graves, motherfucker." Or maybe I'll put a smaller coffin in my coffin and a smaller one in there, and it'll keep going like Russian nesting dolls. And in the smallest coffin would be a sealed envelope covered in tiny specks and a slip of paper that says, "Congratulations, now you've got scabies." It'd be like when your parents gave you the biggest present at Christmas, but you unwrap it and then there's a smaller present inside, and that keeps happening until you have a mountain of wrapping paper and some new socks and a lot of unresolved anger. And that's exactly what it's going to be like when people try to disturb my corpse. Except instead of new socks, they'll get glitter and scabies. Worst Christmas ever. I have tried many torturous techniques to make my outsides fit the ridiculous standards society has set, but it never ends well because my body lives in reality, and it's a reality that has too much cheese in it. I blame Photoshop, my friend Miley once told me. I use Photoshop to make my waist smaller and my neck longer, and then I feel like I need to make those things happen in real life so the people on the internet don't see me tagged in a non-touched-up picture and say, "Oh my God, what happened to you?" And then I have to pretend that I've been in a fire or something. Photoshop is a terrible enabler, I agreed. I always make myself thinner and my hair less awful if I publish my picture online, and then I want to Photoshop someone else's upper arms over mine and soften my knee cellulite and Photoshop a less covered in cat fur outfit onto me. It would be easier just to say fuck it and Photoshop a cat falling out of a window on top of my body and be like, "Yep, perfect selfie. This shit is done. Publish." I shared my grandmother's platitude about what's inside counting more than what's outside, and Miley raised her eyebrows in appraisal. "I never thought of it that way," she said. "Maybe my uterus is stunning." "I bet it's magnificent," I said. "You've made some of my favorite people in there." Miley nodded. "I should do a live webcam of my uterus and call it What's Up, Miley." I wasn't sure it would play on prime time, but it would probably be more redeeming than the Kardashians. I'd recently been to a spa that offered wrinkle removals, but I just read that some places use dead people's donated skin to fill in wrinkles, which is insulting because it's like saying, you look so awful that we think injecting dead people into your face might be an improvement. Although now that I'm thinking about it, I bet the donated skin is only helpful when it's pulled out of a young and still collagen-filled corpse, which seems a little like bathing in the blood of virgins, but with less blood and more injections. And where does that skin come from? What if it's penis skin? Or ball sack skin? No one wants the skin of someone's nutsack injected into their lip wrinkles. In fact, when I see heavily cosmetically altered people, my first thought is, I wonder how much of their face is genitals. My second thought is that they probably got their corpse skin from grave robbers. And that's why I told Victor to leave a warning in my coffin of scabby glitter, telling potential robbers not to inject my corpse into rich old people's faces. Then Victor said that he was going to put a lock on his office door, since apparently I don't understand what was or wasn't acceptable to say while he was on a conference call. This isn't to say that I am completely averse to cosmetic surgery, or even that I've never had it before. Victor recently found a picture labeled Jenny, age 7, after the procedure. I was unconscious, and I had an enormous cast on my head. What in the hell happened to you? He asked. Are those metal bars on the windows? I leaned over to glance at the photo. I think the bars were on the hospital bed to keep me from falling out. I was always falling out of beds at that age. He stared at the giant brain cast and then at me and then nodded to himself. This explains so much, he whispered. It looks worse than it really was. The doctor who did my tonsillectomy decided that since I was already under anesthesia, they should fix the wonky ear that I'd been born with. I suspect it was not his area of expertise and that he was just bored or high and thought, hang on, I want to try something, because I woke up to a misshapen head cast where giant bushels of hair stuck out in awkward clumps. I looked like if a drunken child tried to make a papier-mâché hat on an angry snuffleupagus. A week later, they removed the cast, some of my hair, and what little dignity I had left. My ear looked exactly the same as before, so the doctor told me to sleep with a headband over my ear for the next year because that would work just like a retainer, and it absolutely did if the point of retainers is not to work at all. 20 years later, I tried elective surgery again when I got tired of wearing glasses and decided to get laser eye surgery. The clinic tried to upsell me on what they referred to as superhuman eyesight, but I told them that I wouldn't want to be able to see through clothes because that would really ruin Thanksgiving dinners for me. They explained that it just meant that I'd have better than 20/20 vision, but it was too expensive. And honestly, I prefer things a little soft and fuzzy around the edges. The world always looks nicer when it's a little blurry. That's why so many of us have a second glass of wine at dinner. The eye surgery was fine, except that they used an older suction tool that made me go temporarily blind in whatever eye they were working on, which was unsettling. This is the opposite of what I want, I may have screamed during the procedure. Apparently, it was a rarish sort of reaction, so they don't warn people of it beforehand. Also, I was like, you guys, I smell something burning. And then I realized it was me. The doctor later explained that it was the smell of a chemical reaction which just happens to smell exactly like burning flesh, and this is why I don't trust doctors anymore. That and the ear thing. Still, the eye surgery mostly worked, and I got to stop wearing glasses for several years until my eyes got all shitty again. That happens, by the way. You expect that you're fixed forever, but your eyesight continues to fade as you get older, which actually ends up being a nice coincidence, because the older you get, the less clearly you want to see yourself in the mirror. A few weeks ago, my friend Brooke Shaden came to take my photograph. She was set to do it a few years ago, but I was always sure that I'd be a little thinner the next month, and so I kept procrastinating and putting it off until Brooke eventually decided to just come to me. She's one of my favorite photographers. Her work is dark and unsettling and beautiful, and I imagined the photo shoot would be glamorous and insightful, and it was at least half of those things. We drove to a swamp where I wore a thrift store evening gown and a cape made out of a tablecloth. Brooke wanted me to sit on a tree branch that was several feet above my head. Victor and Haley had come along for the ride, so Victor decided to grab my feet and throw me into the tree, which actually worked. But then when it was time to come back down, I was totally stuck. Victor suggested that I step into his clasped hands and then fall over onto him, but apparently I wasn't doing it right because Victor kept grunting and yelling, "Just fall into me, Jenny." And I said, "I am falling." And he said, "No, you're just crouching on my hands. Fall onto me." And I was like, "I'm falling as hard as I can, Victor." And he yelled, "You're not falling right." And I said, "Falling is the only thing I can do right. I can't fall any better than this." And then Haley yelled, "You guys, I found a kitty." And that was disconcerting because we were in a swamp and most swamp kitties end up being rabid skunks. But it was good timing because it caught me off guard and I fell across Victor's shoulder. Unfortunately, the pressure of Victor's shoulder was like being punched in my stomach and caused me to fart extraordinarily loudly. And that was me, farting and screaming and flailing upside down and grabbing onto the back of Victor's pants to prop myself up so I could frantically scan the swamp for diseased skunks. I'm not sure I have the words to describe that moment, but if there's a word that means the exact opposite of ladylike, that would be a good start. It was mortifying, but Brooke smiled widely and said it was perfect because she thought that she had captured my essence. Victor volunteered that it would have been hard to avoid my essence, but I'm pretty sure he was just making a cheap fart joke. A week later, Brooke finished my portrait, a photograph of me as the oxymoronic bluebird of happiness. Locked in my cage, but still blithely optimistic, even as dark clouds swept around me. It was me, with all my bumps and wrinkles and even a hint of my wonky ear. And it wasn't pretty. It was better than pretty. It was goddamn potato-rific. Chapter 29. It's called Cataflage. For the past several months, I've been getting these giant goose egg bumps on my head. I called my sister, who was an EMT for several years, to ask if she thought that they were cancer. Lisa sighed and said I need to stop thinking that everything was cancer, as it was more likely that the bumps were silent twins that I had absorbed in the womb, who were just now starting to sprout into new heads, who, she hoped, would not inherit my habit of calling her at 3 a.m. to ask if they had cancer. Then she hung up because she has terrible bedside manner. Or maybe her EMT license had expired and she wasn't allowed to diagnose cancer over the phone anymore. I don't know. I sort of preferred the job that she had before she was an EMT when she was a professional clown because she always had candy in her pockets and if I was sad, she would make me a balloon poodle. The bumps would appear almost overnight. They were the size of itchy half golf balls and eventually turned into smaller bumps, which I assumed were hives from my anxiety disorder. My shrink agreed, but suggested that I visit the dermatologist next door just to make sure it wasn't something more serious. A few days later, I went in for the exam, and the doctor glanced at my scalp and said, rather dismissively, "Oh, that's just a folliculitis staph infection." And then I stared at him, and he explained, "Your rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease, which makes you more likely to get infections like this. Take these pills." I explained that I was concerned because I'd always heard that staph could be super deadly, but he said, "You'll be fine. It's like acne, but on your scalp. No one ever died from acne." I thought he was being awfully nonchalant, and he thought I was overreacting. I pointed out that he had just told me that I have a staph infection spreading toward my brain, and he was all, "Where are you getting this from? You have a rash on your head." And I clarified that my brain lives in my head, and I was a little concerned that I was having to point this out since he's the one that's supposed to be the doctor. Then he shook his head in almost the same way Victor does, told me to stay off the internet, and walked out of the room to call in my prescription. Of course, I immediately pulled out my phone to see what he was so afraid of my looking up, because I'm pretty sure stay off the internet is code for I fucking dare you to Google that shit. This is a terribly lazy way to tell me I'm dying, I thought. When the doctor returned, I showed him my phone accusingly and asked him why he was prescribing medication that treated, quote, malaria, anthrax, and cholera. He told me that this was exactly why he didn't want me on the internet and pointed out that this specific medication was also used for treating acne. And he's right, But it's still disconcerting. It's like taking a pill for a stubbed toe that also cures the plague and grows back missing arms. I was getting mixed messages. Was this a serious medical affliction that I should be getting pity and bed rest for? Or was it nothing? He assured me it was mostly nothing and told me to take the malaria pills twice a day. Then I showed him a weird bump I've had on my leg for like the last 8 years, and he said, "Yep, that's just a bump." And then I started to question whether this man was even a real doctor. Regardless, it's nice to hear, no, it's not cancer. And I suppose it's also nice to not have to worry about picking up malaria, even though it wasn't really a worry that I had before this appointment. The most unsettling part of the visit, however, came when the doctor casually asked if I had ever considered having any work done, as they were having a special on Botox. And then I stabbed him in the knee with a pen. But just in my mind, because you can never find a pen when you really need one. In reality, I just told him that I wasn't a fan of paying money to inject paralyzing poison into my face, and that I was actually quite proud of my laugh lines, which I view as a badge that tells people I'm not an asshole. He countered that it was really the frown lines between my eyebrows that he'd focus on. I pointed out that I had gone through a lot of living to get that frowny wrinkle, and I wasn't about to erase it now. My husband made that line, I said, with a defensiveness that surprised even me. This line represents every time I have ever argued with him about everything in the damn world. It is a line that says, "Don't cross me or I will cut you." It is practically a medal for time served, and I earned it. He nodded, surprisingly easily, and went back to filling out my chart. "But," I admitted, "I would be okay with you taking that weird bump off my leg. I don't have any personal relationship with that bump." He looked at it closer and told me that he could remove it, but that it would leave a big hole and a scar. I decided to pass because it seemed wasteful to pay to have a different type of disfigurement when I could just keep the one I accidentally grew for free. As the doctor walked me out, he told me to, quote, "stop worrying so much," because it is possible that some of that rash actually is hives caused by nerves, and I made a note to tell my shrink the breaking news that the medical world had finally found the cure for my severe anxiety disorder, and the prescription is, just stop worrying so much. My God, we've come so far with science. Later, I called Lisa to get a second opinion, and she reminded me again that she wasn't a doctor and that we live in very different time zones and that she was going to start turning off her ringer after midnight. But she perked up when I mentioned my leg bump because she realized that she has the exact same bump on her leg. I asked her if she had ever had it looked at, and she was like, "Why would I have it looked at? It's just a bump, dingus." And that's when I realized that she would have made a great doctor. She told me that it was good that I was on malaria pills because with my luck, I probably already had malaria anyway, and she had a point. She also said that I should have the surgery to remove my leg bump because then I could use the hole where it had been for people who want to do body shots out of it. I was pretty sure no one would want to drink alcohol from my scarred, puckered leg hole, and she said, "Come to LA, there's always a market for something." She's probably right, but I suspect that the people who would want to get drunk out of my leg hole wouldn't be the people that I'd want to have getting drunk out of my leg hole. That's just one of those truisms of life. Lisa said I'd never get a job as a living leg shot glass with that attitude. I'd like to think that job doesn't exist with any attitude. Regardless, now I feel old and wrinkly, and I probably would be considering Botox right this moment if my friend hadn't just had it done, and now one of her eyebrows is slightly lower than the other one because it's too relaxed. She asked if it was noticeable, and I told her no, and then it just looked like she was constantly puzzling over something, so if anything, it made her look pensive and intellectual. And she seemed fine with my answer, I think. Or she was really mad. That's the bad thing about talking to someone whose face is slightly paralyzed. You never know if they're leaning toward you for a hug or to punch you in the neck. Lisa groggily took all of this in and pointed out that it seemed slightly suspect that my therapist encouraged me to go to a doctor who then made me feel old so I would be forced to make another appointment with my shrink to discuss the midlife crisis that I didn't even know I was having until he brought it on. I nodded. And then when I go back to see my shrink, she'll probably rub poison ivy all over the chair, so I'll have to keep seeing the dermatologist. And eventually, I'll probably start to suspect that I was being played, but no one would ever believe that my shrink was poisoning me, so Victor would force me to see my shrink again to get treated for my unfounded paranoia. Bingo, Lisa said. Now you're thinking like a doctor. Or maybe a psychopath. It was more likely the latter, because my shrink is sweet as pie and has the clear and innocent face of someone utterly unfettered by a guilty conscience. Or possibly of someone who has an addiction to Botox that she's financing by sending the dermatologist extra clients. Either way, I probably need to stop thinking about this. It's giving me wrinkles. P.S. My doctor assured me that staph infection of the head is easily treated and most likely won't eventually spread to my face, brain, and body, but just in case, I've been practicing using a cat for camouflage. I call it cataflage because it is more fun to say. Basically, I just carry the cat around and put him up to my face to cover any imperfections or blemishes, or double chins. Sadly, I now have to use cataflage to cover up cat scratches as well, so it's a bit of a catch-22. It's nice, though, because you get to wear fur, but no one from PETA is going to yell at you about it. Unless I staple Ferris Mueller to my neck, then they'd probably get all pissy about cat stapling. But I would never do that, because that would be ridiculous and cruel and would probably lead to even more infections. And then Dr. Yep, that's a bump, all right, would be like, yes, I know you think these marks are vampire bites, but you probably just have an infection from stapling cats to your neck. Stop doing that. Here's a pill for that, and also it cures testicular decay and loss of eyeballs. So that's why I'm thinking that maybe I should just get one of those baby slings to put Ferris Mueller in so that I can wear him on my chest without staples. I need someone to get me a baby Bjorn with a tail hole cut in it and some bed rest and some malaria. Might as well get my money's worth. Chapter 30. We're better than Galileo. Because he's dead. I have learned that every person in the world is on the spectrum of mental illness. Many people barely register on the scale, while others have far more than they could be expected to handle. Even specific disorders are incredibly individualized. For example, my depressive disorder comes and goes, and when it's gone, I have a hard time remembering how I could ever have felt as lost or numb as I get during those times. My anxiety disorder, on the other hand, is always with me and comes with all sorts of niggling bonus disorders and phobias, like some sort of terrible boxed set. I struggle with a host of phobias, like agoraphobia, the fear of being in a situation where escape is impossible if things go shitty. I have acute social anxiety disorder, aka anthropophobia, which is the fear of people. I don't have arachnophobia, an irrational fear of spiders, because fear of spiders is perfectly rational, so I refuse to recognize that as a disorder. I also have arachnoanthropophobia, which is the fear of people who are covered in spiders. I made up that last one, but it's still a valid concern. The fear of people is something I think most introverted, socially awkward people understand, but I tend to take it a step further. Into a place filled with weird shame. The disorder manifests itself in strange ways, but when I'm having a bad spell, I can't make myself interact with the outside world. I even find myself hiding in my own home, my panicked heartbeat in my ears when someone comes to the door. This would be easier to handle if I were in another room, but I am inevitably home alone and sitting in my office near the front door when the doorbell rings. Usually my blinds are closed, but they're always raised a few inches so the cats can look out at the world that I'm avoiding. Can they see my feet, I wonder, as I freeze and hold my breath, waiting for whoever is at the door to leave? Maybe they'll think I'm a mannequin, I whisper to myself. I slowly bring my feet up to my chair seat, my knees at my chin, quietly and in slow motion to avoid catching their attention, watching their feet to see if they respond to mine, if they've noticed me. Then I sit there, perched in a fetal position and feel ridiculous, physically hiding from the world. The cats look at me strangely. I'm being judged by cats, mostly because they wonder where my lap has gone since it's their favorite chair. The worst thing is when the person outside waits and rings again. Someone who rings once is just doing his job, but someone who rings twice is a madman. The real psychopaths will keep waiting and sometimes even call our home phone as I sit there, paralyzed, thinking the call is coming from outside the house. I never answer. Eventually, the person leaves, and I'm left to wonder who they were. These are dark times. It could have been a serial killer, or a member of the local church. Someone to tell me a bill was late, a magician with a wagon full of magic, a utility worker to warn me of a gas leak, or perhaps it's just a person who wonders who I am. Who was that girl who lifted her feet almost out of sight to hide from a perfect stranger for no conceivable reason at all? Who would do that? Honestly, sometimes I wonder myself. It's hard to explain anxiety disorders to people. The things that scare others don't scare me. I'm fine with snakes and clowns and needles. I can sit in morgues or hang out with the dead. I can look down from dizzying heights or hunt for ghosts in abandoned asylums. Most people are afraid of speaking in public, but I am fine on stage and can speak comfortably in front of 1,000 people. The scary thing is not being on stage. The terror and dread is in the millions of potential problems getting to that stage. What if I get lost? What if someone recognizes me? What if no one does? Where do I hide until it's time to go on? What if when I'm hiding, people see the real me, the terrified me, who is boring and strange and has frightened, panicked animal eyes until she's on stage and knows she's in the right place and has no other choice but to speak? Then the terror melts away for a few minutes because, at least for those moments, I don't have to make decisions or wonder what my face is doing. I can relax because for that brief time, I have no other choice but to breathe and move forward. Some people are afraid of flying, and I am too, but not in the way that you think. I'm afraid of getting stuck and lost and paralyzed every single step of the way from my house to the plane. The only time that my fear abates is when I'm actually in my seat and the plane takes off. It's not until that moment that I have no other choices or mistakes to make, and so I can relax for a few minutes, while the people who are afraid of flying in a normal, understandable way suddenly tense up and clench their armrests in panic. I always look at them with pity, and I wish I could explain to them that their fear is irrational, that we'll be fine, and that even if we aren't, it'll all be over soon, and there's nothing we can do about it. I consider telling them that, but then I worry that they'll keep talking to me, and I can't have that, because I need the hour before we land to be quiet, so I have time to study and memorize the terminal maps of the airport that we'll be landing in, and triple-check that my notes about every step of travel are right, and worry about the unknown place we'll land, and the myriad of spots that I could become lost. The normal, scared of flying people will exit the plane with obvious relief, and I can't help but feel envious, both that their irrational fear is one normal people understand, and also that it's one that ends as they leave the plane. My fear is just ratcheting up again, and it will last until the moment I'm back in my home and can melt. Your body isn't meant to deal with that much fear for that long, so when I travel a lot, I get sick. Physically and mentally. I explain to people that it's my autoimmune disease, and people understand, but my autoimmune issues are just one part of the puzzle. It's also the terror of leaving my safe space at home, where I've built up a smooth veneer of protection which cracks so quickly. It wears away each minute until I'm finally exposed and raw and can't move from exhaustion. It is a conflicting bundle of emotions. When I travel on book tours, I meet the most amazing people, some who love humor, some who love the dark, some who stare at me with my own terrified eyes and whisper that this is the first time they've left their house in weeks. Those are my favorite people. The ones who, like me, are scared, but come out anyway, alone, and find themselves making friends with the other people in line who are just like them. It's what happens every week in the comment section of my blog, but it is so much more lovely to see it in real life. During my first book tour, I didn't know how draining and terrifying it would be. A week and a half into one of the tours, I sort of lost it. It wasn't a complete breakdown that would come later when I got home and couldn't move for weeks. This was simply overstimulation and terror and having no routine to calm me. When things got really bad, Victor and Haley would fly to wherever I was that day, and we'd hide in a hotel room and watch TV and snuggle. It was exactly what I needed. Better than the massages I was too afraid to book, or the parties I couldn't make myself go to, or the vacations I turned down. It's hard to write about this without giving the wrong impression, and I worry about that. I love that a special tribe of people understands and enjoys my writing, and I am incredibly lucky to have found them. I love walking into a signing and finding out that the bookstore is out of seats and that the book vendors are shocked at the turnout of the hundreds of strange and wonderful misfits who are standing and smiling and wearing red ball gowns and holding metal chickens. I love that such a strange little book was a bestseller because of the amazing groundswell of underground readers who supported the book and who got the attention of others who found the book or blog and found their place in our strange community. It's hard to understand anyone's being depressed or anxious when they've been given a gift it seems like anyone would kill for. At best, it seems ungrateful. At worst, it seems disgraceful, but still, it happens. Some of the moments that, from a normal person's perspective, seem like they should have been the greatest moments of my life were actually sometimes the worst moments, and no one ever tells you that. Probably because it sounds crazy, but that doesn't make it any less true. I wish someone had told me the simple but confusing truth. Even when everything's going your way, you can still be sad or anxious or uncomfortably numb because you can't always control your brain or your emotions even when things are perfect. The really scary thing is that sometimes that makes it worse. You're supposed to be sad when things are shitty, but if you're sad when you have everything you're ever supposed to want, that is utterly terrifying. Why am I curled in a ball in my hotel room bed, too self-conscious to enjoy life, feeling like a failure and a fraud while a party in my honor rages on? How can I feel so awful and sick and guilty and sweaty with panic when things are so perfect? If everything is perfect and I'm miserable, then is this as good as it gets? And the answer is no. It gets better. You get better. You learn to appreciate the fact that what drives you is very different from what you're told should make you happy. You learn that it's okay to prefer your personal idea of heaven, live-tweeting zombie movies from under a blanket of kittens, rather than someone else's idea that fame or fortune or parties are the pinnacle that we should all reach for. And there's something surprisingly freeing about that. It is an amazing gift to be able to recognize that the things that make you happiest are so much easier to grasp than you thought. There is such freedom in being able to celebrate and appreciate the unique moments that recharge you and give you peace and joy. Sure, some people want red carpets and paparazzi. Turns out, I just want banana popsicles dipped in Malibu rum. It doesn't mean I'm a failure at appreciating the good things in life. It means I'm successful in recognizing what the good things in life are for me. This makes sense because at the end of your life, no one ever says shit like, "Thank God I got to ride an elephant." Instead, they say, "I wish I'd spent more time with loved ones." So if you spent an hour playing the floors made out of lava with your kid, then you're better off than the girl who traveled all the way to Sri Lanka. Plus, you didn't get cholera. Probably. I mean, depends, I guess. This doesn't mean that I don't make myself go to conferences and tours and vacations, because I do. I know that I'd become a hermit if I didn't push myself outside, so I try to say yes enough to experience wonderful things and meet amazing people without overwhelming myself. I'm just very picky about what I do because I know I don't have enough spoons to do it all. Do you know about the spoons? Because you should. The spoon theory was created by a friend of mine, Christine Mizarandino, to explain the limits you have when you live with chronic illness. Most healthy people have a seemingly infinite number of spoons at their disposal, each one representing the energy needed to do a task. You get up in the morning, that's a spoon. You take a shower, that's a spoon. You work and play and clean and love and hate, and that's a lot of damn spoons. But if you are young and healthy, you still have spoons left over as you fall asleep and wait for your new supply of spoons to be delivered in the morning. But if you are sick or in pain, your exhaustion changes you and the number of spoons that you have. Autoimmune disease or chronic pain like I have with my arthritis cuts down on your spoons. Depression or anxiety take away even more. Maybe you only have 6 spoons to use that day. Sometimes you have even fewer, and you look at the things that you need to do and realize you don't have enough spoons to do them all. If you clean the house, you won't have enough spoons left to exercise. You can visit a friend, but you won't have enough spoons to drive yourself back home. You can accomplish everything a normal person does for hours, but then you hit a wall and fall into bed thinking, I wish I could just stop breathing for an hour because it's exhausting, all of this inhaling and exhaling. And then your husband sees you lying on the bed and he raises an eyebrow seductively and you say, no, I can't have sex with you today because there aren't enough spoons. And he looks at you strangely because that sounds kinky and not in a good way. And you know you should explain the spoon theory so he won't get mad, but you don't have enough energy to explain properly because you used your last spoon of the morning picking up his dry cleaning. So instead, you just defensively yell, I spent all my spoons on your laundry. And he says, You can't pay for dry cleaning with spoons. What is wrong with you? And now you're mad because this is his fault too, but you're too tired to fight out loud. And so you have the argument in your head, but it doesn't go well because you're too tired to defend yourself, even in your head. And the critical internal voices take over and you're too tired to not believe them. And then you get more depressed. And the next day you wake up with even fewer spoons. So you try to make spoons out of caffeine and willpower, but that never really works. The only thing that does work is realizing that your lack of spoons is not your fault and reminding yourself of that fact over and over as you compare your fucked up life to everyone else's just as fucked up but not as noticeably fucked up to outsiders' life. Really, the only people you should be comparing yourself to would be people who make you feel better by comparison. For instance, people who are in comas, because those people have no spoons at all, and you don't see anyone judging them. Personally, I always compare myself to Galileo because everyone knows he's fantastic, but he has no spoons at all because he's dead. So technically, I'm better than Galileo because all I've done is take a shower and already I've accomplished more than him today. If we were having a competition, I'd have beaten him in daily accomplishments every damn day of my life. But I'm not gloating because Galileo can't control his current spoon supply any more than I can. And if Galileo couldn't figure out how to keep his dwindling spoon supply, I think it's pretty unfair of me to judge myself for mine. I have learned to use my spoons wisely, to say no, to push myself but not too hard, to try to enjoy the amazingness of life while teetering at the edge of terror and fatigue. This weekend was a perfect example of that. I was asked to speak at a conference and I said yes, but just getting from my house to the hotel in San Francisco was exhausting, so I was too tired to actually go to the conference or to eat or even to get a cab. I locked housekeeping out because I needed to feel like my hotel room was a protected place, that no other emotions which I might have to battle with were mingling with mine. That sounds mad, but it's true. I can feel other people's emotions. Their life force, maybe? Something. It's uncomfortable, but in a way that's hard to define. Like a sweater you can't appreciate because it's itchy from an allergic reaction you can't explain. I take pills to dull my overactive senses, and it makes me able to love the sweaters and people and life, but then the pills wear off, and I'm terrified again, and I want to run away and scream and have someone rescue me. But the only one who can rescue me is me, which is hopeless because I am unreliable and paralyzed, and my stomach lurches, and then I know I'm going to be physically ill, a physical manifestation of my brain that equates to my body ridding itself of everything it can. I used to think it was fight or flight. On my worst days, I think it's my body's way of mutinying, of deserting me in any way it possibly can. The hotel I was booked in was in the bad part of the Tenderloin District, seedy and fascinating and scary and depressing and exciting. It was also filled with homeless people who seemed to be huddled in groups on every street. I'd managed to successfully avoid seeing anyone, but there was no room service, so if I wanted to eat, I would have to walk down the street. The problem was I couldn't get more than a few steps without being blocked by a man or a woman who was either severely mentally ill or very high or both. I'd walk a few feet and see a shirtless man sitting in a doorway screaming, "Give me a dollar!" to people as he grabbed at their feet and spat at them. And then I'd turn to go the other way and I'd see a furious woman screaming angrily at someone who wasn't there. It happened on every street and I kept turning back until I had no other streets to walk down. And so I just walked back to my room to eat the peanut butter crackers that I had brought with me. It's not that I am afraid of homeless people any more than non-homeless people. I'm afraid of something much more complicated. I look at them and think, is that my future? Because that's what I'd become if I got stuck and was forced to be around people without a break. Screaming and terrorized and stuck, huddled in a doorway each day. Lost. Never moving, no options. It's how I feel now, except that I'm blessed to be stuck in a room with clean sheets and a bottle of pills that I can carry with me that I hope will give me the numb courage that I will eventually need to call a cab and go to the airport and do a myriad of things that normal people don't think about, but that I obsess about over and over until I have taken that taxi and gotten lost in the airport 100 times in my mind before I actually have to do it for real. I panic that I'll get stuck. I stand at the door of my hotel room and look out at the real world, and I'm terrified that I'll just stop, that I won't be able to leave, or to call a cab, or to get on the plane, that I'll be stuck forever, like those people in the streets. I'm lucky because I have options. I have medications and therapeutic tools and breathing techniques. I have friends and family I can call to come rescue me if things get too bad. And I have the internet. That sounds weird, but Twitter is a lot like having a large, invisible gang of equally messed up people who will hide with you in bathrooms and make you laugh under the pillow fort you've built in a lonely hotel room. Many of them suffer from the same fears, which keep them similarly isolated, but we've found a way to be alone together. There's something wonderful about experiencing life with friendly strangers and stranger friends who all fit in your pocket. They celebrate your successes. They send you videos of hedgehogs in bathtubs when you are down. They tell you you are not alone. And suddenly, you aren't. They turn horrific experiences into ones you can laugh about with your friends, these odd strangers who walk with you, keeping you company late at night during a panic attack, or when you're awkwardly sitting alone at a table in a public place and accidentally mortify yourself, which is coincidentally exactly what happened to me that weekend at the conference. Since the hotel I was staying in didn't offer a room service, I had been surviving on the peanut butter crackers I had brought with me, but on the final day, I decided I needed to have real food before I did my speech. So I decided to brave the world and go to the restaurant attached to my hotel. What followed was a humiliating series of events which would have left me devastated had I not been able to laugh about them with Twitter. And that is the awesome thing about introverts. They're often on their phones or computers, so it's like you're with friends even when you're alone. In a nutshell, I tried to take a subtle selfie of how awkwardly alone I was in this fancy dark restaurant, but I forgot my flash was on. And then when I tweeted the picture, my phone made this loud wolf whistle. And in a rush to leave, I tripped over the edge of their fancy koi pond. And then I stepped on a fish. And the fish was fine, but my right shoe was a mess. So I tried to use the ceiling fan in my room to dry my shoe, but it was taking too long. And I couldn't speak with a shoe that was making squelching noises. So I stuck my shoe onto the fan blade because I thought maybe the inertia would force the water out. And it seemed to be working until I turned the fan up too high and my shoe shot off the blade and hit me in the face. It was like I was being kicked in the head with my own stupidity. But Twitter was there through it all, reminding me that if I did actually manage to get my shit together, no one would know who I was anymore. And that is why I love the internet, because they turned a really horrific moment into a memory I could laugh about later because I was experiencing it with people who could commiserate or at least appreciate it as a terrible, terrible train wreck. And it was good and terrifying. And I survived, even though I had to go on stage with a slightly squelchy shoe and then hide in my room immediately afterward. I continue to do what I do because that is life, and because one day I'll maybe get used to this. Maybe one day I'll have the same reaction to life that I have when I'm locked in a plane or I'm on stage. Maybe I'll be able to relax and enjoy my life without letting fear keep me from living it. Maybe one day I'll easily acknowledge the frank truth that I have no other choice but to breathe and move forward. Chapter 31, Things My Father Taught Me. Always pull a tank dog out of the hole by his tail. Also, tank dog is a fairly awesome name for an armadillo. You can't leave a donkey in the car, but you can take it into a bar, and then you can never go back to that bar again. If you have too much grass and your neighbor has too many goats, you should just rent some of your neighbor's goats to eat your grass. But make sure you get all female ones, because otherwise you'll end up with too many goats too. Too much grass and not enough birth control. That's how goats are made. If you want to learn the Native American way to skin buffalo, you should let a bunch of them come and live in your yard. Native Americans, that is, not buffalo. Honestly, we barely had room for all those goats. The grass is greener on the other side of the fence, but only because most people don't have a bunch of rented goats in their backyards. Those fucking goats eat everything. You can trade 3 goats for 1 slightly used kid's motorcycle. You can trade 1 slightly used and now vaguely crashed kid's motorcycle back for those same goats if you just make sure to trade really bad goats the first time around. They should change "you can't handle the truth" to "you can't handle these goats" because it's more realistic. Goats are terrible to handle. When life gives you lemons, you should freeze them and use them to throw at your enemies using some sort of trebuchet. Also, you should never ask your father what a trebuchet is because he will show you. It's like a catapult, but more complicated, and inevitably it breaks or the goats wander into its path and run away dazed. On the other side of fear is freedom, and usually fewer fingers than you started with. Everyone is born with extra fingers. God expects you to cut a few off during your journey. Otherwise, he wouldn't have made power tools so awesome. If you toss a freshly killed deer on the kitchen table with its stomach on the tabletop and its front legs on one side and its back legs on the other, it'll look less like it's flying and more like it's just badly failed at the hurdles. It's a bit funny and horrible all at once, much like life. Always shoot first, because bears don't shoot. They just eat you. You are never going to win if you wait for the bear to get in the first shot. This is all just basic hunting 101. There will be moments when you have to be a grown-up. Those moments are tricks. Do not fall for them. Refrigerators are good for keeping homemade moonshine less gross. Freezers are good for keeping rattlesnakes less angry. Garages are good to hide in when your wife finds either. If you leave the freezer open, the rattlesnakes will thaw and bite your hand. I'm not sure if this is an actual fact or just a way that my father used to get my sister and me to close the freezer quickly before letting all the cold air out. But this is such an electricity saver that I'm considering using the same tactic on my daughter, but without the actual rattlesnakes, because that would be insane. Don't make the same mistakes that everyone else makes. Make wonderful mistakes. Make the kind of mistakes that make people so shocked that they have no other choice but to be a little impressed. Sometimes stunned silence is better than applause. You don't have to go to some special private school to be an artist. Just look at the intricate beauty of cobwebs. Spiders make them with their butts. Be happy in front of people who hate you. That way, they know that they haven't gotten to you. Plus, it pisses them off like crazy. You can make a hat out of a cat's face, but that doesn't make it a good hat, unless you line it first. Don't sabotage yourself. There are plenty of other people willing to do that for free. It is perfectly okay to keep a broken oven in your yard as long as you call it art. If you're going to buy glass eyeballs, you should buy them in bulk because you're going to need more. Glass eyeballs are like Pringles. No one can have just one, mostly because you seldom taxidermy one-eyed animals, unless maybe you're making them wink at each other, or maybe they're pirates. If you stick a couple of giant glass eyeballs made for taxidermied cow heads inside your glasses, you will freak a bunch of people out. You will probably also fall and break your hip, but it will totally be worth it. There's a point when roadkill is much too decomposed to be used in taxidermy, but it is several weeks after a normal person would expect. You can make a very convincing taxidermied Sasquatch out of a deer's ass. They don't sell well in the taxidermy shop, but it's always very entertaining when gullible people get an inch away from a deer's butthole to stare at it with wonder and skepticism. Most Sasquatch sightings are probably just deer who are walking away from drunken hunters. Normal is boring. Weird is better. Goats are awesome, but only in small quantities. Hand me those eyeballs.